Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on the 18th of April, these are our main stories. President Putin visits Russian troops in occupied Ukraine. The American journalist Evan Gershkovich has had his appeal against detention in Russia rejected by a Moscow court. Sudan's rival generals have agreed a 24-hour ceasefire following 4 days of intense fighting in the capital, Khartoum. Also in this podcast... Apple opens its first store in India. Russia says President Vladimir Putin has visited occupied parts of Ukraine's Kherson region. We've seen videos appearing to show Mr. Putin visiting military installations. A statement said he heard reports from Air Force and Army commanders. A Ukrainian presidential adviser said Mr. Putin was visiting the area, in his words, to enjoy the crimes of his minions for the last time. The BBC's James Waterhouse, who's in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, told me more about this rare trip and when it could have happened.
Vladimir Putin can be heard on camera talking about the upcoming Easter. So we can say that it was before last weekend, perhaps. But I think what this is more about is what the Kremlin is trying to convey. It does certainly appear that Vladimir Putin, in a familiar dark outfit, being escorted by senior officers, was visiting military bases across occupied southern and eastern Ukraine. We're told that he was in the eastern Luhansk region before visiting part of the southern Kherson region, which is under Russia's control. He can be heard telling officers, "Don't let me distract you. I'm here in a business-like capacity." And this is a part of Ukraine where Russian forces have been really digging in, boosting their defensives ahead of a much anticipated or expected Ukrainian counteroffensive, which has not happened yet. I think it's Moscow saying, we aren't going anywhere and everything is going to plan.
Mind you, we can't independently verify this, can we? I mean, can we be sure it was even him? Because we know, don't we, that President Putin has got body doubles.
Yes, there are question marks around that. It's certainly something Ukraine likes to question when Vladimir Putin posted a visit to occupied Crimea and the southern city of Mariupol last month. It certainly appears to be him, but you're right, there are plenty of unknowns, which is why I think it's more helpful to look at the messaging that Moscow is trying to convey rather than what is being depicted. But if it was the case that Vladimir Putin is stepping onto occupied territory, then this represents a continued departure from him refusing to sort of leave the cover of Russia. It is a definite change in tactic to be seen to appear inside Ukraine.
And what's your sense of what's going on there? Is it all about a spring offensive now, do you think?
It's getting talked about over and over again. And I think the reason for that is there is a pressure on Ukraine to act this summer when conditions are at their most favourable, where they will want to use this culmination of Western support, notably tanks, to try and concentrate them in one area and break the deadlock and retake territory as much as possible. Now, there are question marks over Ukraine's capacity to do that. The sounds coming out of Kyiv is that Ukraine isn't quite ready yet, but you can be sure they will be keen to change the dynamic of this conflict. At the moment, Russia remains in control of a sizable land grab.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. The US journalist Evan Gershkovich, who was detained in Russia last month, has appeared in public for the first time in court and been denied bail. Mr. Gershkovich is charged with spying. He's the first American journalist to face espionage charges in Russia since the Soviet era. He and his employer strongly deny any wrongdoing. I spoke to Polina Ivanova, a journalist with the Financial Times who covers Russia and Ukraine and who's also a close friend of Evan Gershkovich.
We've had regular updates on his conditions from his lawyers, who are visiting him very regularly. And we've also been sending him letters, and we've heard that he's receiving them. And he's also started handwriting replies. I personally received a letter from him just yesterday, which is the first one, and friends and family are receiving letters now from him.
And what is your sense of his mood?
He's strong. He's not been broken by this situation. He's strong. He's holding up. He's being witty and funny. He's caring about his friends and their how their state, you know, their state of mind, and he's caring about his family, and he's being very strong.
He appealed today, just in the last few hours, against being detained, and he lost that appeal. He's charged with spying, very serious charges. And how did he look to you as he appeared in court? Because, of course, you knew him beforehand.
He looks good. He's smiling occasionally. There were people that he would have recognized in the courtroom that would have also given him a boost of support. There were other journalists in the courtroom, and this will also have brightened his mood to know that there are people who support him, not just all over the world, but also on the ground in Moscow at this very, very trying time.
And how are you and others intending to support him from afar? Are you going to write to the Russians as well and perhaps try and see the Russian ambassador here in the UK?
I know that lots of diplomatic efforts, lots of efforts are being done on all levels by everybody who cares about Evan's case. Us personally, one of the main things that we are doing as his friends is trying to support him and keep attention on his case. And the, one of the ways that we want to support him is we've set up this post box, an email address, which people can write to and people are writing to from all over the world with words of support for Evan. We are translating those letters and posting them in Moscow, and they are reaching him.
Polina Ivanova. After 4 days of intense fighting, Sudan's rival generals have agreed a 24-hour ceasefire. The country's de facto leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, said that the ceasefire would start later today. Some elements of the army have denied this. The head of the rival Rapid Support Forces, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti, said he approved the ceasefire to ensure the evacuation of wounded civilians. Hundreds of people have been killed and injured by airstrikes and shelling in crowded residential areas. The Red Cross says it's impossible to help people in the capital, Khartoum. The BBC's Lucy Hawkins has been speaking to Dalia Abdelmonium, who lives in the capital.
We're making do. We're trying the best that we can. It's a very horrible situation for anyone to be in. And where we are, we're at the heart of the clashes between both the RSF and the army. So we have no sleep. We've had no sleep whatsoever. We're tense. We're very agitated, and we don't know what's happening. We can't get a clear picture of what is exactly happening outside. We've had no power since Saturday afternoon. Not one. We have a solar battery which we charge and then we can switch on for a few hours, which allows us to charge our phones or our laptops. And that's about it, basically.
Dalia, can you give us an idea of how noisy it is?
We were woken up at 4 o'clock this morning with the sounds of blasts and explosions and gunfire, and it hasn't let up. It's nearly now 1 p.m. and it's just been ongoing since 4 o'clock this morning. And we try to grab a nap here and there. And it's even that, then you get woken up by a huge blast. The windows are shaking. Our house is made of cement. It's concrete walls, and the whole house was shaking. So we just jump out of bed or the sofa we're sleeping on, and we just move into this room, which isn't exposed to glass or to windows, and we just sit there and we just wait until things calm down, and then we can go back to our rooms or our, you know, the space that we can move into.
How do you talk to her and to each other about the future, Dalia, and how do you imagine this ending?
I keep telling her it can't get any worse than this, and it has to get better because we've hit the lowest point that we can. And that everything that starts, there is always an end, and hopefully the end is soon. And I just try to comfort her in that way, that, you know, she'll look back at this and realize this was a momentous period in our history as Sudanese, and she can always say that she was witness to it, and things can only get better from here, honestly. I mean, I can't see how much worse it can get.
Dalia Abdelmonium. An 85-year-old man has been charged with assault after he allegedly shot a black teenager who'd mistakenly rung his doorbell in the US state of Missouri. Andrew Lester, who's white, apparently shot at 16-year-old Ralph Jarl through a glass door on Thursday. There were protests after the pensioner was released from detention without charge before being rearrested. A prosecutor says the case has what he described as a racial component. The BBC's Rob Young spoke to Ralph's aunt, Dr. Faith Spoonmore.
So Ralph is 16 years old. He loves music. He loves school. He loves his family. And he spends a lot of time with his family.
What happened last Thursday?
My sister asked my nephew to go ahead and pick up his younger siblings from a house that is not too far from where they live. And he accidentally went to the wrong house. He rang the doorbell, and the man in the house came outside and shot him in the head, and then shot him again when he was on the ground. Luckily, because Ralph has a will to live, he was able to get up and run to get help, and he was able to get help.
How is he doing?
He's alive. Ralph is out of the hospital. He does have a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, because he was shot in the head. My focus and my family focus with Ralph is just trying to remind him of how much he is loved, share with him all of the support that he's getting from the community, and just basically surrounding him with a lot of love.
What can you say about the identity of the person who shot your nephew?
I do know that the person is white.
And so is it your view that there may well be a racial element to this shooting?
Absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Because I live in America.
How does all of this make you as a black woman feel about the place you live? Not just the town, the city, the state, but the country.
Makes me feel very worried and very scared. Like, this is my home. However, it is not my home. And I don't feel safe. My kids don't feel safe. Quite clearly, my nephews cannot feel safe. And that is heartbreaking.
And do you have faith that justice for your nephew will be done?
That is why I'm having this interview. Because that is the goal.
So you're not entirely certain?
No, you can never be certain of anything.
Faith Spoonmore. Until 5 years ago, gay sex was illegal in India, but a few hours ago, the country's Supreme Court began hearing a series of petitions to legalise same-sex marriage. At least 18 same-sex couples have petitioned the top court, arguing that not being allowed to marry deprives them of rights, including opening joint bank accounts or co-owning a house. The government and leaders from India's main religions are firmly opposed to a change in the law. Let's hear some of the discussions from inside the Supreme Court.
There is no absolute concept of a man or an absolute concept of a woman at all. That's
Lord,
the whole argument in a broader context.
Biological man, my lord, means man only. It means, my lord, biological man.
Biological man is not a definition of what your genitals are. It's far more complex. That's the point.
I spoke to our correspondent in Delhi, Geeta Pandey, who's been following proceedings.
It's a very lively debate that's been happening in the Supreme Court since the morning today. And in fact, the Chief Justice has said that he's going to conclude the arguments on Thursday. So I would think that the judgment would be coming, I would think, within days after that, or maybe in a few weeks after that.
And how much support do you think there is for a change in the law?
Well, there is definitely increasing support. Because ever since the 2018 judgment that you spoke about earlier, which decriminalized gay sex between consenting adults, had come, perceptions have been changing in India, attitudes have been changing. There's a lot more acceptance. In fact, even Pew Research found out that there's been a lot more acceptance, and the acceptance of homosexuality has been constantly growing. Having said that, there is still a fair bit of discrimination and stigma attached to it. And I think a lot of it is coming out in the way the government of India and our religious leaders from all major religions have been protesting against the Supreme Court wanting to hear this case, and the same-sex couples challenging it in the court.
And what's the opinion in rural areas? They tend to be more conservative, don't they?
Well, I mean, you know, if the numbers are growing, then in rural areas or in semi-rural areas also, the number of people who identify as LGBTQ plus people has been growing according to the globally accepted estimates. The 10% of population in any country is supposed to be LGBTQ plus, which will mean that India has 135 million LGBTQ plus people. And that's not a small number by any calculation.
Geeta Pandey. Coming up.
I feel awful that my young children are working. This is their time to study and be something. But life is hard for us. I'm struggling to find work.
The UN warns that signs of recovery in Afghanistan risk coming undone.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings the globe to your ears through original documentary storytelling. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A contraceptive for men could be on the market within the next decade after US researchers conducting a study made a major breakthrough. Dr. John Oatley is a professor in the School of Molecular Biosciences at Washington State University and also the senior author of the study. He told us more about what they discovered.
We have identified a gene that encodes for a protein called ARRDC5 that seems to be expressed and present only in testicular tissue of every mammalian species, humans included, that we've explored so far. And the reason this is important is that it checks many of the boxes we're looking for when we're trying to develop a non-hormonal male contraceptive approach. One of those boxes is that it seems to be expressed only in testicular tissue, which is important because that means if we drug it to try to inhibit it, that we won't be impacting other systems or the health of a male. The other is that it seems to only play a role in that very final steps in putting sperm together. If we try to inhibit earlier steps in the process of making sperm, then the chances of reversibility are less. And so by only having a role in that kind of final step, if you think about it like assembling a car on an assembly line, it's like putting the tires on at the very end. If we're inhibiting just that final step, then the chances of it being reversible are high. I think that the impacts that developing a non-hormonal male contraceptive can have on the world are huge. I just liken it to the development of the female birth control pill in the 1960s. Prior to the development of the female birth control pill, the average number of children that a woman had worldwide was 5. And 20 years after the development of the female birth control pill, it was down to 2. And that's because people were being able to choose when they wanted to have children. I think the next frontier is male contraceptive development.
Dr. John Oatley. The UN says there are signs of recovery in Afghanistan's economy, but they're weak and under threat of being undone by the Taliban's recent restrictions on women working at NGOs, which could lead to a significant drop in aid. The Taliban has told the BBC that the rules imposed on women are internal matters for the country, and their government is working to pull the country out of economic collapse. From Kabul, the BBC's South Asia correspondent Yogita Lamai reports.
I'm in a market in Kabul. There are stalls on the road, food items, shoes, clothes being sold. It is fairly busy, and on the face of it, it gives you the impression of a country that seems to be running normally. But the reality is that this is a country in economic collapse. Millions of Afghans don't know where their next meal will come from. And one of the things that we've seen repeatedly on the ground is increasingly children being put to work so that they can earn some money. We're going to meet a family which has two young boys working. It's because of their earnings that their families eat every day. 11-year-old Saeed Ali Akbar beats a molten iron rod into shape. Less than 4 feet tall, he uses a hammer that's almost as big as he is. His face is streaked with dirt and sweat. For 9 hours every day, he must work at a blacksmith's shop so that his family can afford food. He used to go to school until last year and was in the sixth grade.
I really liked school. I miss it. This is very hard work, but I've got used to it now, he says. Next door, his older brother Alisena does the same work. Together, they earn 150 Afghanis a day, less than $2. Their father lost his job when Afghanistan's economy collapsed and has now gone to Iran to find work. Their mother, Leela, told us she begs on the streets.
I feel awful that my young children are working. This is their time to study and be something. But life is hard for us. I'm struggling to find work and they have to provide for the family.
What is the Taliban government doing to try to help its people? We've come to the Ministry of Finance to meet with Miraj Mohammad Miraj, the Director General of Revenue for the Taliban government, who has said that the income of the government has increased by 37% over the last year. How have they managed to do that? I'm just about to ask him. Your country is in economic crisis, but you've seen an increase in income. How have you managed to do that?
Basically, in the previous government, there were a lot of corruptions and misuses of the power of the government. We have transparency in all our departments, and there is a very good 37% of increase in our revenues.
Two-thirds of your population currently does not know where their next meal is come from. That is not a self-reliant economy. So how crucial is the operation of aid organizations at this moment?
These are temporary things. Thank you for the international community helping our people in all over Afghanistan. But this is not the solution. We need the international communities to come and work with us.
But it is the policies of your government, including the restrictions on women and girls, which are making it tougher for aid organizations to operate in this country. Is your government willing to take responsibility for your share of what you should be doing to further expand the aid that is coming to your country?
I think all the things, all the humanitarian aids and the donations and the grants, those should not be related to this issue only.
The gap between Afghanistan's rulers and the world is widening at an unexpectedly rapid pace. Its people are at risk of being left to fight a crisis on their own.
Yogita Lemay. And now, the countdown leading to Apple opening its first physical store in Mumbai. About 300 people had been waiting for the opening, and some of the fans took selfies with the chief executive of the tech company, Tim Cook. The BBC's Arshana Shukla spoke to me from Mumbai.
It was marked by long queues of fans, some of them standing there outside the store for hours together. There were cheers, there were sounds of the Indian traditional dhol, clapping, and hundreds of selfies that marked the opening of Apple's first store in Mumbai. Tim Cook himself was present for the launch. That speaks a lot about how Apple is viewing India and how crucial they think about the country and the market that he himself was present for the launch. There were lots of excited staff, very well-trained Apple staff, and long queues of fans waiting for the opening today.
A lot of people listening to this will be surprised to hear that Apple hasn't opened a brick and mortar store in India before now.
Well, yes, they have been wanting to open it for the last 4 or 5 years or so. Initially, the local sourcing norms for single brand retail stores like Apple to set up store in India, the norms required for local sourcing of products was a little more tough. In 2018, those norms were brought down, and then Apple wanted to open a store, but it was delayed because of the pandemic. And now they're back here in brick and mortar. But before that, if you realize, India was not really a big market for Apple 5 years ago. The Indian customers find Apple as an aspirational product, much more pricier and premium than what they can normally afford. Just an example, the cheapest iPhone in India is about $800. And an average Indian salary is about $400. So, you know, it's twice as much as an average Indian salary. So this was really not a market for Apple also earlier. But in the last 5-6 years, they've actually seen an increase in sale of their products in the premium category. It's the, you know, as the purchasing power of people have gone up, more and more people are wanting to buy products.
Archana Shukla. Scientists have found dozens of species of shellfish and sea creatures that have been able to survive and reproduce on a vast floating island of plastic waste drifting in the northeastern Pacific Ocean. Known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the rubbish which is now teeming with these animals covers a vast area of the ocean. Our reporter Terry Egan spoke to the BBC's Alex Ritson.
This conglomeration of plastic lies between California and Hawaii, and it has an area of 1 million square kilometres, roughly twice the size of Texas. It's been estimated that the mass contains 1.8 trillion bits of plastic that altogether weigh 80,000 tonnes. Some of this plastic accumulated after the Japanese tsunami of 2011, but most of it comes from the fishing industry. And holding all this plastic together is a kind of vortex of water, one of five huge circular currents in the world's oceans. And this new artificial island has turned into a mini metropolis of life.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, it seems dozens of different species are surviving and reproducing very happily there. Some are normally coastal creatures, tiny crabs and anemones, living what is in effect thousands of kilometres from their usual homes. They wouldn't be able to live in the open oceans, but they can survive here, and many might have travelled on bits of plastic, like rafts, you might say, being drawn in by the vortex. Unusually, these coastal creatures are living side by side with open water creatures, though they might also be eating each other.
Yummy. This is symptomatic, though, of a much bigger problem, isn't it?
Yes, there's been a huge increase in ocean plastic pollution since 2005. The UN says humans produce 460 million tonnes of plastic every year, and that's only going to increase. Only about a tenth of that is recycled, and more than a fifth of it ends up as litter, a lot of it winding up in the ocean, including now helping to form this giant island of rubbish.
Terry Egan. A German photographer who turned down a major award after revealing his entry was generated by artificial intelligence has defended his actions, saying he wanted to fuel a debate on the issue. Organisers of last week's Sony World Photography Award have accused Boris Eldiksen of misleading them about the extent of AI that would be involved in his picture. Boris Eldiksen explained to the BBC how he created the image.
It's not an enhancement, it's creating an image in many different steps. You start to create one image just by a description, a text description, and then you change parts, you erase parts, and you add parts, and so a smaller image becomes a larger image by in-painting and out-painting. I'm permanently surprised what is possible. I got into AI last summer, and I have been using it on a daily basis since, and it's amazing how fast it advances. I think it's very important not to call it AI photography, but to say it's something in itself. So I think it's very important to differ it by terms, and then to have an open discussion in the photography world. Is the umbrella of photography large enough to say, okay, it's part of it? Because it is related. The language, the visual language is the same, but it's different at the same time. Do we want to put it into one basket, or would it be a mistake? It's a very complex question, and I just wanted this discussion to speed up.
Boris Eldiksen, and you can see that image in the culture section of the BBC News website. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Philip Ball. The producers were Adam Chowdhury and Olivia Noon. And the editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.